Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This podcast is free, and it's accessible to everyone thanks to support from listeners like you. If you value this show, please consider supporting its production by donating to our home, KUOW. It only takes a minute to give, and you'll be helping to support the production of this podcast. Make a donation at kuow.org or follow the link in the show notes. And thanks!
About 700,000 years ago, a new creature arrived in North America, trotted across the Bering Land Bridge, and spread across the continent. Working in packs, they flourished. They divided and conquered, living among mammoths, giant beavers, and lions, shaping entire ecosystems. There were probably 2 million of them historically in what is today's United States, in balance with the space and prey. But in the blink of an eye, it all changed. Overnight, the landscape became blanketed with a new species, humans. And with the arrival of Europeans, almost complete annihilation of this formidable carnivore, Canis lupus, the wolf. A creature that still fills our folklore and myths. And one that is making a comeback in Western America. It's a comeback that some people love.
We hear this wolf howl at the drainage. It's about a mile away. You hear this beautiful melodic wolf howl just kind of start caressing the night sky.
Some, on the other hand, hate wolves.
If you gotta live with wolves that are bad, that have gone bad and bad and bad, bad, you can't live with them. They gotta go.
There's probably no other species in the wild that elicits more division than wolves. The sides usually come down to ranchers who fear for their cattle and environmentalists who fear the extinction of an animal they value and see as critical to the balance of nature. Today, we're gonna saddle up, take to the hills of eastern Washington State, and meet a man whose job is to literally stand between the cattle and the wolves, to keep the peace in today's Wild West. From KUOW in Seattle, I'm Chris Morgan. Welcome to the Wild. I'm in cowboy country, the Wild West, and the front line as wolves return to this part of the world. I'm here to meet a man named Daniel Curry, and a horse named Griff.
Hey, bud, can I say hi to you, Griff?
Yeah, you're my cookie.
Griff is Daniel's most trusted horse.
Oh, is that good? Now we're friends, huh?
Daniel would have no problem passing as a cowboy. He's got the horse, the boots, he's even got two revolvers strapped around his waist. I've driven 8 hours east from home on the Washington State coast where I live. Behind me are the thick, impenetrable forests of the wetter west side. We're now in drier, more open pine forest and pastures. A place with a long tradition of cattle ranching. Idyllic. But there's a rub. The cows that roam here are no longer alone. Wolves came back about a decade ago, and their numbers have been growing at about 28% per year, and it makes for some deep tension between those who love them and those who hate them. Daniel's job is critical to the safety of these cows. He's what's called a range rider. In some ways, he's like a modern-day shepherd.
A lot of ranchers will say, oh, is this new range riding thing? And I'm like, well, technically, it's kind of an old thing. We used to just call it cowboys, you know?
But he's also here to protect the wolves, too. For the next few days, I want to learn about the world Daniel's found himself in. And there's no better perspective than from the back of a horse.
He looks like he's raring to go. Like,
okay, yeah, his work ethic is pretty extreme. So. Yeah.
My horse is named Raven. He's midnight black with a bit of a stubborn attitude. Definitely got a mind of his own.
He's almost got dreadlocks.
Yeah, I know. I was thinking about cutting that thing.
Look at that. It is a dreadlock.
Oh, it's totally a dreadlock.
We mount up. Daniel's a lean 6'5" with shaggy hair and a goatee beard. In tow are his dogs, a lively gang of three young Dobermans he calls the lads. They're part of his all-animal team too.
Follow, little dog.
It's a beautiful corner of the world. Rolling hills, dotted with Black Angus cows and 100-year-old wooden ranch buildings in various states of collapse.
Thousands of endless acres where you're like, oh man, I can literally ride all day, you know, and not see the same spot twice.
An artist or black and white photographer's dream. Daniel is heading out to check on the cattle in the area. This land we're on sits right next to the Colville National Forest, so it's also home to predatory carnivores, cougars, bears, and of course, the wolves.
There's always going to be overlap. We know that. I mean, this is a forest. There's wild animals out here. This is the national forest and the, you know, federal grazing allotments, and there's all kinds of wild animals out there.
It's not just the wolves that are wild. Dan's horse, Griff, keeps pushing Dan to cut loose. You can tell Griff has a wild streak in him. This horse really just wants to run.
That is such a frustrating thing, not trying to hold you back, Griff. It's like trying to hold back a Ferrari.
Griff is not a fan of our slower pace today.
Should have been a racehorse, little brother.
Making rides like this among the cows is all part of Daniel's daily routine.
So the whole goal of mine is, quit doing this moonwalk, is you find out what predators are present, find out how they're utilizing the landscape, find out where cows are, how many there are, you know, how many am I dealing with?
Daniel's job is to keep the wolves from preying on the cows. And there are plenty of other animals for the wolves to eat, deer, beavers, hares, but the cows, they're an easy meal. And it's understandable, at least from a wolf's perspective. Now picture it. A wolf. Maybe a couple of them. Standing at the edge of a meadow, they're looking through the trees. Upwind of them on the left is a 400-pound elk. This big deer is finely tuned in every way to avoid being eaten, and has a kick that can kill. Just 50 yards to her right is a 400-pound cow-calf, not so finely tuned for a face-off with a predator. If you're the wolf, which one would you go for? It might take a wolf a little while to figure things out, but once they do, it's a tough habit to break. As Dan said, it would be like us seeing a pizza sitting in the forest during a long, exhausting hike, tempting as hell. Once wolves have learned that cows are a food source, it's hard to break them of that habit.
What we're trying to do is just associate cows as a non-food source.
Daniel's trying to condition these animals to stay away from cows. And he does that by riding alongside the herd, high on horseback, making himself as visible as possible to the wolves.
Aversively condition them using negative stimulus in the form of human presence, or if that didn't work, if like I go into a herd and there's a wolf there and just that presence doesn't work, I'll approach the animal at that point and just say, hey, you gotta be pushed out of this area.
Things are pretty quiet the day I'm out with Daniel. We meander among the cows for a couple of hours, but no predators in sight.
No scat, no tracks, no anything that alarmed us. That's kind of what we're looking for, though. It's a nice, calm, easy going, just cows mooing day.
Yeah. Happy cows.
Happy cows are better cows.
There are about 126 wolves in Washington now, in 27 packs, and most of them want nothing to do with humans or their cattle. Those are the wolves Dan wants to keep around.
We'd rather have a pack up here that we know isn't eating cows, and that'll keep that land secure from other packs, hopefully, and they'll continue to teach that trait, just like the theory is when you lethally remove a pack, or members of a pack, not the entire pack, they'll teach that trait to the offspring and other things. So why not start way before and condition them to where they never hopefully cross that bridge and just kind of keep disseminating that knowledge down through generation of generation of wolves?
This lethal removal Dan talks about is one way that wildlife officials attempt to manage wolves. Entire wolf packs have been eliminated when they kill too many cattle. After our ride, the sun had gone down, and we settled next to the campfire. Dan's sitting on a log, his cowboy boots resting against the edge of the fire. It was an ideal Wild West scene. But despite Dan's cowboy look, he's not from around here. He was raised on the other side of the mountains, the busier west side, a world away from cowboy country. It was his love of animals that drew him to this range. He tells me it was an affection that started very young, almost out of necessity.
I had a raging alcoholic as a father, and he was abusive to my mother. And so a lot of the times I was home alone with, you know, Honey, our dog, Golden Lab, and just a sweetheart of a dog. And just nobody was around except for animals, and I really bonded with them.
Then Dan had an epiphany at the ripe old age of 4.
I remember having a distinct memory when I was 4, thinking like, when I become a man when I'm 5. I remember thinking that. I was like, when I'm 5, you know, you kind of, that's it, man. There's the pinnacle. You're a man. I remember thinking like, I'm going to do something for animals because of what they've given me over the, you know, course of my four and three quarter years or whatever at that time. And I remember just being really, really wanting to give that back.
His mum encouraged this passion and helped his love for wildlife grow, including quite a collection.
So I had goats, chickens, iguanas, snakes, Euromastics.
Anything feathered, scaled, or furry, he had it. So when a job opened up at a wolf sanctuary south of Seattle, his path became clear. He was 20 and would go on to spend the next 10 years rehabilitating wolves that couldn't make it in the wild. Along the way, he learned all there was to know about this ancient ancestor of man's best friend, including the fact that wolves were not for everybody. Then in 2008, something big happened in the wolf world. A female and a male from Canada met, fell in love, and moved south across the border into Washington State. For the first time in over 75 years, the wolves were back. Then more came, here into eastern Washington from Idaho. Things immediately started to get heated in cattle country. Most cattle ranchers were not ready to accept the wolf back, a big predator that might literally eat their livelihood. So, as the wolves spread west, Daniel decided to head east, across the mountains, to meet the whole thing head on and protect the wolves.
I was feeling, you know, kind of anxious, and I was like, well, I want to do something positive for wolves, so I found a current population pack of wolves, and I put my finger in the middle of the map, and I said, I'm going to go there, and I'm going to do something. What, you know, I had friends and family who were like, what are you going to do? I was like, I don't know, you know, but we're going to do something.
So he dropped off his menagerie of animals at his mom's house and drove east. He arrived in Colville, the small town where his finger had landed on the map. He didn't know a soul.
You know, I called my brother. I was like, dude, I don't know what to do, man. I'm up here. I don't know anybody. I mean, that was the first question I always got. Oh, you have family up here? No. Well, you have a wife and a kid? And no. Like, you have friends up here? And no. They're like, what the hell are you doing up here? And I was like, well, I'm trying to help wolves and humans. And they're like, well, how are you doing that? I was like, I don't know yet.
But he could ride. He knew wolves, loved teaching people about them, and was super resourceful, totally at home in the woods. Then one day, he hears about a job as a range rider with the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. He applied and got the job. So on the day before his 31st birthday, he saddled up and headed out on his trusty horse, Griff. It was the beginning of a long journey. He rode hard that first day. He was now responsible for keeping 500 head of cattle out of the mouths of wolves.
I didn't see a single cow. You know, it was like, I spent all day, didn't see one cow. It's like, well, I didn't see one wolf or one cow. How am I going to get in between them? You know, so it kind of created a little bit more of an aware state in my head of what it was going to take and what was currently going on. So,
not seeing any cows that first day wasn't necessarily unusual. You see, in this part of the world, the cows are not all fenced in a field. They roam for miles, and often through the national forests where they're allowed to graze and wander freely. Wild areas that can be hundreds of thousands of acres in size. They're called public federal grazing allotments. And remember, this is where bears, cougars, and wolves live too. You can imagine what the outcome might be, having big carnivores and easy prey in the same hills. Some of the wolves are radio collared, and as his work got started, Daniel was excited to track them, find out more about how they were moving around the cattle and the ranches, what they were up to, kind of piece it all together.
Okay, the first day that I worked, I come out and I have my telemetry equipment and I'm all excited. I was like, man, I haven't gotten a signal, but I can't wait to get a signal, you know, and then because now I know where they are, you know, now I can maybe go talk to that person and say, hey, there's a wolf up on your hill and what can I do to help you? And this and that. And just that's kind of how it started, was, you know, just getting in there and getting your hands dirty, so to speak.
Dan has special memories of one of the very first wolves he tracked, Wolf 52. She was a young, lone female that would often cruise through the backyard of the house he rented under the cover of the night.
That first day, I was tracking her for, it was probably a good couple months. She was doing really well, staying out of people's business, not messing with any livestock or anything like that.
Then one night, he was getting home after a long day in the field.
I was coming back home and it was snowing, heavily snowing. It's probably 10:30, 11 o'clock at night. And I'm kind of tired. I got the skis in the back of the rig and I'm driving along and I see this set of tracks come out. And they go right up the road in a straight formation, you know, and that's always, you know, kind of like, oh, okay, this is probably more like a wild animal, not a dog zigzagging and you know, messing around.
Unlike a dog, wolves tend to run in a straight line, very focused, and that's all he had to see to know what he was looking at.
I didn't even have to look, but just a little bit. I was like, that's fresh wolf tracks. There's not even, you know, four snowflakes in there. And it's like snowing heavily. I was like, okay, that's like, I'm just behind that animal.
And it's not like there's a wolf around every tree here. Every single wolf is very important and legally protected. So even though it's 11 at night, he knows that these fresh tracks can help him piece together the life of this wolf and maybe keep her out of trouble.
She went down that bank and politely skirted the fence, didn't even come into my property. I was like, well, I'm not done with work. I'm going to go find out what this wolf is doing right here in the neighborhood, you know? So throw the skis on and I'm skiing up the hill and I'm tracking her, and she went right to where I had cut my Christmas tree, tracked where I tossed the little stub of the Christmas tree. And then started to go back towards my house, and I lost her like 150 feet, and I couldn't cut her tracks anymore.
Daniel wondered if Wolf 52 had recognized his smell and then associated that with where he lived. It was like she was keeping an eye on him, just like he was watching her. But just 3 days later, things took a turn.
I woke up at 6 and was driving down the road, just doing my normal patrol down Aladdin, and got a really weird signal on the telemetry device, a really rapid beep, and I knew what that was. It was a mortality signal.
A mortality signal from a radio-collared animal is triggered when the collar hasn't moved for 24 hours. Something was wrong. Daniel wasn't sure what to do. The signal was booming in from down the slope through the trees, but he couldn't find the wolf or the collar. So he leaves, heads back home to call his boss, who tells him to go back out and search again.
And I drive back out, and that signal had crossed the road somehow.
In the time it took him to get back to where the signal was, the collar had crossed the road. But the collar was no longer on the wolf. It was in somebody's house.
And the animal was placed back on the other side of the road around an aspen tree. She had been shot with an AR-15 like twice. And it was all just unnecessary. She hadn't done anything. And then she was just crossing the road one day, coming back over to kind of where I live, where she did most of her stomping, and somebody saw her on the side of the road and shot her with a AR-15 a couple times in the chest for no reason, just being a wolf.
Daniel had been tracking her for 6 months as she cruised the landscape looking for her own territory and a mate. I get the sense that Daniel has learned to kind of camouflage his emotions. It's not a popular thing to like wolves around here. But I can tell the loss of Wolf 52 got to him.
I was horrible, man. I was really bummed. You know, having that kind of personal interaction with this animal for quite some time, and that was the first animal I ever, you know, had the interaction with on the this job site, so to speak, or, well, this job period. Like, that's
So that was your first wolf, right?
Yeah.
When you come over here for this job. Did that crush you or make you feel, this is what I'm here to do?
Oh, it poured gas in a already broiling fire, man. I mean, it was already a fire. I've had that in my heart for years, you know, and I just kind of doused a bunch of gas on it after, you know, a moment of grief out there and just saying, that sucks. It was just really, really sad. It was just kind of heartbreaking.
He never did find out who killed Wolf 52. And things only got more intense. One rancher told Daniel if they saw him out on the land, they'd shoot him. But he knew he had to push on, no matter how nasty things got.
The best way I could serve that animal and this community would be to move forward, you know, and use that personal soul-ripping moment out and say, nope, we're gonna work harder.
Hey, my name's Claire McGrain, and I'm a producer for Seattle Now, KUOW's local news podcast. There is a lot happening in our region, and it's a lot of work to keep track of it all. We'll get you caught up on the latest news and take a deep dive into something happening around the city, all in under 15 minutes. Get a morning walk in, or grab a cup of coffee, and start your day with us. Learn something new and connect with our city by searching for Seattle Now wherever you get your podcasts.
You could see where the wolves were hanging on to the calf, and they had all 4 feet locked up.
This is Jake Nelson. He's a rancher. His family has about 400 head of cattle.
And there's this wolf tracks, side by side, coming right down the road. They're pulling apart. When they mean business, they pull them apart, and it ain't very good looking when you get there.
One day, in the fall of 2018, he was rounding up cattle on his ranch when he came across a male wolf. It growled and started to approach him.
I actually had one come at me, trying to attack me up here in the South Fork Lone Ranch. I shot it.
He injured the wolf, and it had to be euthanized. Sometimes entire packs are killed to protect cattle by the state government that's there to manage the wolves.
If you gotta live with wolves that are bad, that have gone bad and bad and bad, bad, like mine have, you can't live with them. They gotta go.
Jake lives the other side of the story. I meet him at his house in the little town of Danville, right next to the Canadian border.
Thanks for letting us intrude on a Sunday night.
He's in his mid-30s, his leather chaps are covered in mud, and he's just in from rounding up some cows for the winter.
Oh yeah, nice and warm in here.
I ask him what it's like to lose a calf to a wolf.
Well, it's like having 400 kids. I treat every one of them like I would treat my kid. So when you show up there and one of them's laying there dead, it don't make you feel very good.
One year he lost 18 cows to wolves. They've become a threat to his entire existence as a rancher.
I work 18, 20 hours a day, 365 days a year now, because of the wolves. Because I got dealt a bad hand. The dollars don't add up. There ain't no dollars to add up. So my future is not very bright right now.
But the wolves are here to stay, and Jake is not about to give up. He's determined to hang on to his very last cow. He sounds a lot like Daniel. Daniel and Jake were destined to meet, and they did in 2017, just over the hill from where we were now sitting. Daniel had been called in to check on some suspected wolf activity, and they struck up a conversation. They realized that both of them wanted the same thing. To keep the cattle safe. If the cattle were safe, ranchers wouldn't lose income, something Jake desperately wanted. If the wolves didn't attack the cattle, the ranchers wouldn't want the wolves dead, something Daniel wanted. Daniel says this shared sense of purpose forged a bond between the two of them.
No, I remember thinking, work stuff alone, I was like, I could be friends with this person. He's a good person, you know?
These two guys from opposite sides of the wolf story both came at it with open minds.
My number one rule in life is give everybody a chance. I don't care what you look like, shape, size, it don't matter. I give Daniel a chance, and he came through.
Tonight, they're sharing a beer together. Jake says whenever Daniel is out riding on his land, he doesn't see any wolf kills. It's the range rider's presence that's key. So even though Dan might not see the wolves, they probably see him.
Daniel might be in the South Fork Lone Ranch, and they go up and chase a group of cows into the North Fork Lone Ranch. They're going to go over there and kill the cows in the North Fork Lone Ranch because Daniel's in the South Fork. So it's all a preventative thing. You got to be there way before this problem ever starts happening.
Daniel and Jake agree. The wolves look for patterns and can pick off cattle when the humans aren't looking. Daniel even has video footage of wolves coming into an area just 20 minutes after he's left.
So I don't think that's a coincidence at that point. I think they're a pattern-watching animal that's like, there's nobody there. I'm going to go and take advantage of this situation.
Yeah, they're super vigilant, right?
And for a wolf, remember, it's simply about survival and feeding their families. Most wolves don't live more than about 6 or 7 years. It's a tough life.
Does it make you feel like there's no hope for wolves and cattle? Is it wolves or cattle, or is there room for both?
So if I have to answer it honestly, there's definitely room for wolves and cattle. There's definitely not room for these wolves and cattle.
Meaning the local wolf pack he's dealing with will be hard to stop. This pack has learned to view his cattle as prey. But even so, since meeting Dan, Jake's view of wolves has evolved.
Wolves are doing what wolves are designed to do. They're designed to kill and provide for their family, just like you and every one of us are too. So it's not the wolf's problem or the wolf's fault that they're doing that.
Jake's cautious tolerance to wolves is pretty unique among the ranchers in the area. But this hasn't helped him win friends with wolf lovers. Some of them also take matters into their own hands. After he shot that wolf in 2018, Jake received death threats. A car parked at the end of Jake's driveway for days. The people in the car were watching Jake and his family with binoculars.
For whatever reason, they think it's right in their mind that if a wolf dies, then they need to come kill us. If a wolf dies, they just want to come. They'll call you up, tell you they're going to come kill you. They'll sit down in your driveway, stood in the window looking at them, but they won't do nothing. I mean, I think there's a lot of talk. It's like the bully in school. They think they can push their way around with a lot of people.
Despite the intensity from both sides, Dan has come to terms with the fact that some wolves have to occasionally be killed. And Jake has accepted that the wolves are here to stay. Each of them is adapting.
I would love for the wolves to be here. I would love for my cows not to get killed. We have to step up the presence of the range riders like Daniel. And then I think there's room for wolves and cattle on the same landscape. That's the only way it's going to work.
Neither guy is fooling themselves. They know it's going to always take hard work and determination. Slowly, this place that Daniel came to change, the people he wanted to reach out to, they have changed him too. It's become very personal.
Because now I've met families, I know their names, I know their children's names. I've sat around campfires and had beer with them and ate pizza after a roundup and talked about, you know, philosophies of wolves in the landscape with them. And I've really been able to put myself in their shoes more, so to speak. Well, literally, I guess, you know, mm-hmm. Wear cowboy boots now because I ride horses all the time. So that's helped me just kind of open myself up to that.
If there's middle ground between them, these guys are finding it. And Jake knows they don't have to agree on everything.
Daniel and I have been there 100 times.
Yeah.
Daniel has 100% different beliefs than I have. We agree on a lot of shit. And there's some things that we don't agree on. So I guess in my little world, you could put Daniel at one end and me at the other end, but by us growing how we've grown and getting to know each other, I mean, he knows where I am and I know where he is, and I mean, we're down the middle.
Is it trust?
It's a huge part of it, I think.
Huge is definitely a huge part. I would say
respect, too.
Respect.
From my end, I know that.
Dan would love a future for both wolves and cattle here. And Dan and Jake's relationship show it could be possible. Two very different guys brought together by the very animal that separates them. Dan's time in this community has helped him see that there is actually an opportunity, a smarter way forward.
When we realize that ranching isn't done in a perfect way and wolf management isn't done in a perfect way, we can kind of realize that there's always going to be a better way, and we can improve, we can strive for that, making better choices for everybody and raising that bar.
Dan has now been a range rider for 7 years, and he's taking what he's learned and growing it. His plan is to open a wolf center where people from all sides can gather to talk face to face, perhaps around a fire or from the back of a horse, about the things that are important to them.
I don't know, man. Who says that you're right or you're wrong? So that's the whole point of balance. I don't question where I learned lessons either. It could be from a fire or a flower or whatever, and it's like, man, if I learn it from there, then I'll be honored to take that. You want to change the world, you got to change your mind.
As these wolves, these ancient mammals, trot across the landscape once again, making their way through life, perhaps they can spark more open minds in the new Wild West. Starting with a little help from a man named Dan and his trusty horse, Griff. Check out photos and videos from my time with Dan on our Instagram at The Wild Pod. There's horses, mountains, and even his trusty Doberman pals. Thanks to our photographer, Megan Farmer. There's more info about Dan Curry and his work with Griff at our website, kurw.org/thewild. And a special thanks to Kaylee Rudd, without whom this episode wouldn't have happened. You really saved our butts. Thanks, Kaylee. The Wild is going to be back in about a month. The team and I are going to take some time off to produce some more episodes. We've got some fun things in store for you, so keep an eye on our feed to watch out for those new episodes. If you haven't listened to our first season, now's the perfect time to go back and catch up. Episodes about everything from penguins to Siberian tigers and sea lions to beavers. The Wild is inspired not just by nature, but by people who work in it, love it, protect it. We have more information on our website, thewildpod.org. The Wild is a production of KUOW in Seattle in partnership with my work at the Uproar Fund. Our producer is Matt Martin. Jim Gates is our editor. Our production team includes David Brown, Juan Pablo Chiquiza, April Craig, Dyer Oxley, Theo Popescu, Mariah Powell, Brendan Sweeney, and Jeannie Yandel. Our theme music is by Michael Parker. I'm your host, Chris Morgan. Thanks for listening. Keep well and take care of each other. See you back here in July.
Hey, my name's Claire McGrain, and I'm a producer for Seattle Now, KUOW's local news podcast. There is a lot happening in our region, and it's a lot of work to keep track of it all. We'll get you caught up on the latest news and take a deep dive into something happening around the city, all in under 15 minutes. Get a morning walk in or grab a cup of coffee and start your day with us. Learn something new and connect with our city by searching for Seattle Now wherever you get your podcasts.